Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Joining me is tonight's co-host, courtesy of the San Jose office of Berliner Cohen, Josh Borger. By now, well-known as a frequent guest on Your Legal Rights, Josh practices commercial and civil litigation in a variety of arenas. About a year ago, we took a look at the legal environment surrounding the newly legalized marijuana market. We didn't finish. We didn't come close. Tonight, we're happy to be back to complete, or at least to resume that discussion.
In November of 2016, California voters approved the Adult Use of Marijuana Act, Proposition 64, to legalize the recreational use of cannabis for adults 21 and over. Cannabis remains illegal under federal law, however. So how is a business to operate knowing if they're in this realm, they're operating potentially legally under state law and illegally under federal law?
So the real question is, where is all this leading? The federal government, I mean, the states legalized it, but the federal government, not so much. And just how are businesses to operate under a system of regulation that is, to say the least, fluid and evolving? How is a business, often a very large enterprise, how is it to successfully navigate the myriad regulations and stay out of Leavenworth? And what happens when they fail? As always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and answer your questions. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 if you are in the Bay Area. If you're not, if you're outside the local dialing area, you can call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. To help us sort out this regulatory scheme, we have with us, courtesy of Goodwin LLP, Brett Schumann is the chair of the firm's San Francisco office, co-founder and co-chair of the firm's cannabis practice, where he advises U.S. and international businesses in or looking to get into the cannabis industry. His clients range from leading cannabis brands and investors to Fortune 50 companies to emerging companies. He advises cannabis industry clients regarding the federal and state regulatory regimes relating to cannabis, products liability, IP issues, and other issues. He also represents cannabis industry clients in litigation, including leading brands such as Pax Labs and Kiva Brands, Inc.
From Raggianti Freitas LLP in San Rafael, Habib Bentaleb is a corporate attorney with clients both in and outside of the cannabis industry. Habib advises his clients with choosing the appropriate entity structure for their business, structuring ownership, raising capital, drafting and negotiating contracts, joint ventures, strategic alliances and licensing agreements, due diligence, mergers and acquisitions, licensing, and regulatory compliance. Habib regularly speaks at industry conferences and bar associations on the legal issues facing California's cannabis industry.
And from the Encino, California office of Ballard Rosenberg Gulper and Savitt LLP, Richard S. Rosenberg has spent a career of more than 40 years assisting management to defend and risk manage workplace-related legal issues and proposed personnel transactions, and is recognized as one of the state's leading experts of workplace law. Richard's been named as a Southern California super lawyer every year since there was a Southern California super lawyers. Richard, welcome to Your Legal Rights. And Brett Habib, welcome back to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, last year when the show started, we received some breaking news that a federal judge had just enforced a subpoena from the DOJ seeking records from a California regarding California cannabis licensees. We speculated that that might mean the feds are looking at cracking down on the state legal cannabis industry. Of course, we've had some major changes, a changed administration since then. Is there a sense the federal government is any more or less engaged in monitoring the cannabis industry as it now exists, not only in California, but in several states?
Well, I'll take that one, Jeff. This is Brett Schumann from Goodwin. The answer is no. There was some optimism that the change in administration would actually lead to legalization, if not decriminalization, of cannabis at the federal level. That hasn't happened yet, and it may not happen. But there certainly hasn't been anything like a crackdown. In fact, we've had five more states, including large states like New York and New Jersey, legalize adult recreational cannabis in 2021 alone. And there really has become something of a cooperative relationship between the federal government and the state government in terms of going after the illegal, unlicensed cannabis industry. And if you see news reports of raids or busts or things like that involving the feds, that is always a illegal cannabis grow. And many of our clients in the legal licensed cannabis industry cheer that sort of activity.
Habib here. One thing that I'll add to that, I'll echo everything that Brett said. To go along with, you know, no real enforcement mechanism, enforcement actions on by the federal government on legal cannabis operators, what we're seeing here in California, anyway, at the state level, is more opportunities, right? What people fail to sometimes recognize is that California is a dual licensing state. And what I mean by that is that you've got to obtain your local license at the same time and then obtain your license from the state. So basically, the local jurisdictions, right, 482 cities, 58 counties, can regulate as they see fit, and anywhere from outright prohibition to licensing all the different types of businesses. And what we've seen is more jurisdictions decide to license cannabis businesses as they've proven to be able to navigate the new landscape with the COVID and the pandemic, and being able to be open to the public and not have to shutter like other businesses have shown some of the local jurisdictions that it is a potentially good tax base to have in your community.
And Jeff, it's Rich. If I could jump in, I would tell you that from the law of the workplace side of this question, the federal government is very involved supervising and investigating employers who are not complying with federal laws on workplace requirements, whether it's wage and hour discrimination, harassment, those sorts of things. And recently, the National Labor Relations Board, which is the government watchdog agency that deals with union management relations, certified the results of an election for a cultivator, and the union then negotiated successfully a collective bargaining agreement, so a union contract. So I've seen very active enforcement on the state and federal level when it comes to workplace issues.
So bringing us back up to from the last time we were on the air, and other than what we've just talked about with enforcement, are there any other trends, anything that people need to know about that is happening in the cannabis industry, perhaps in the employment realm?
Well, one of the things that is very important here in California for the employment side of things is for businesses and employees alike to understand that we have a provision in our California law that makes it illegal for an employer to discriminate or take any adverse action against a worker who is engaged in a lawful off-work activity. So we get questions that come up all the time. Can we drug test our employees? Can we insist that they don't take drugs as a condition of working for the company? And I would say, especially in regard to cannabis, that I think you can't do that because it is a lawful off-work activity. I realize that the feds consider it unlawful, and I know some employers who have decided to be much more aggressive on that. But when I'm talking to most of our clients that are not in the cannabis industry, that are employing people who use cannabis, they say they're kind of looking the other way so long as the person doesn't come to work so impaired that it would affect their ability to do the job.
What other trends are you guys seeing, whether it's operationally or the structure?
Well, what I would say is I think the last time we talked about this was maybe September of last year, so we were already into the pandemic. But it's probably just worth reiterating for our listeners who may have attended that show. The pandemic, of course, has been awful for pretty much everyone, but the cannabis industry has really thrived during the pandemic. It was early on labeled an essential industry in all states where it's legal, initially not so in Massachusetts, but that changed. Profits are up, revenues are up. The industry has really thrived. As I mentioned earlier, we continue to see a significant expansion of the state legal licensed industry across big states, New York, most recently Connecticut, and that is expected to continue. I'm not much into making political predictions, but I feel comfortable predicting that that is a one directional march towards greater legalization at the state level, which ultimately one day may lead to legalization or decriminalization at the federal level. A number of the more recent states to come online, as we say in the cannabis industry, are really focused on social equity. That's a big, broad term. We could probably do a whole show just on that, Jeff. But essentially, early on, the states to come online were more about tax revenue. And states like Colorado have raked in over $1.6 billion in tax revenue since Colorado was the first state to legalize adult recreational cannabis. What we're seeing more now is social equity, reversing some of the harmful effects of the war on drugs, giving some of those licenses, some of that money to either people who were incarcerated, family members of people who were incarcerated, or communities that were disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs. And New York State may be the furthest on that progression of any state so far. We're still waiting for their regulations to come out. But that's a trend that we're seeing. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, we got a warning shot from Clarence Thomas at the U.S. Supreme Court just last month. One justice, not an opinion, no binding effect. But the steady expansion of the state legal cannabis industry is even reaching the highest court in the land, where Justice Thomas, in a short opinion, opined that perhaps the federal government's prohibition may not make any sense anymore and may not be constitutional anymore. So those are some of the recent trends, at least since we were talking about this last in September.
And Jeff, Rich chiming in again from the workplace side. One thing I've seen is an expansion of our companies that are doing delivery. There are several large delivery companies in California. I've had the privilege of working with a couple of them, and those companies are just expanding like mad to try to keep up with the demand, which was just described. I think due to COVID and everybody being home and the availability of cannabis through delivery, whether it's through the retailer or a separate delivery company, we've seen quite a bit of that.
So something to chase down before you chase down the food that you order next through delivery. Let's talk about some of the other more mundane issues about cannabis law, cannabis business. One wonders about entering into contracts. Suppose I wanted to have weekly delivery or whatever it is. In general, are contracts involving cannabis lawful?
Habib here. I'll take that one, Jeff. That's a good question. Prior to Prop 64 taking effect, you know, we were under Prop 215 and everybody was operating under collectives, and there wasn't a state regulatory regime yet, and there was uncertainty as to whether or not cannabis contracts would be upheld in court, right? For a contract must have a lawful purpose, right? Like I can't sue the hitman for not following through on taking out my father-in-law, right? I joke, I love my father-in-law, but you must have a lawful contract. So that was always a concern. So contracts would generally include, mediation provisions, arbitrations, which are still generally part of how I would structure contracts. But California went and, eliminated any uncertainty when in 2018, they passed a law to the California Civil Code that specifically asserted that California contracts that were at least in compliance with state and local regulations were lawful aspects of contract and law. And that took effect in 2019. So as far as in the state of California, are cannabis contracts lawful? The answer is yes. Once you delve into, federal realm, it becomes a little less clear, and contracts are not always going to be enforceable, at least between two business parties. It's different like Richard was saying, when it comes to labor laws, you know, the federal government will enforce labor laws on cannabis businesses. Cannabis businesses can't say they can't apply, they don't have to comply with federal labor laws because they're federally illegal. That's been routinely dismissed. But as far as the contracts, I'm always advising on, you know, making sure that you have your choice of law provisions being the state of California or, you know, a state of lawful jurisdiction.
Well, let me follow that up, and I'll throw this out to anyone, and just somewhat of what you were touching on. Contracts are governed by state law. So you're in a dispute over, and it involves a contract, a cannabis contract. If the other side knows that the federal court will not enforce it, they're going to try to remove it, which means for those of our listeners, take it to federal court if they can. Is there any case law? Is there any authority right now, even just in Northern District of California, for whether those contracts, if they get removed, even though they're supposed to apply state law where it's legal, is there authority for whether or not they're going to enforce those?
Yeah, I'll take that one, Josh. One of the things that you might want to consider doing is putting in an anti-removal provision in your agreement so you don't wind up in that scenario. I agree with Habib, and not just in California, a number of other states. Massachusetts has a very similar statutory provision to the one that he was mentioning. Many of the adult use states have enacted provisions specifically legalizing or confirming the legality of contracts relating to cannabis. Contracts are, of course, so important in every industry. You can't have a $20 billion industry like we have now in cannabis in this country without enforceable agreements. In federal court, agreements are mostly enforceable. There's a lot of case law now. Most types of cannabis contracts are enforceable in federal court, notwithstanding the fact that you're in, you know, the federal forum where the feds consider cannabis criminal. There are some instances, though, for example, disputes between partners where the requested relief is, you know, you're asking the judge to have the defendant hand over to the plaintiff a share of the cannabis business's profits on a go-forward basis, right? I had an equity interest in the company. Those are the types of cases where we have seen opinions from judges refusing to enforce the contract. And one way to avoid finding yourself in that scenario is to make sure that the case remains in a state court through something like an anti-removal provision.
That's outstanding advice. For everyone out there, you heard, removing is something that lawyers will tell you to decide whether or not they think it's beneficial. Removing it means taking it from a state court and bringing it to federal court. The advice you just got, which is sage wisdom that I hadn't thought of, is putting in the contract that you have to stay in state court. That is going to, sounds like, be the cheapest and the easiest way to ensure your contract is enforceable.
Let me turn it over to Libby in Oakland. Libby, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi there. I just had a question kind of looking at other industries that have kind of like a three-tier model. I'm thinking particularly of alcohol, which have basically been shown in recent years to be especially kind of arguably stacked against small producers, small brands like a brewery or a distillery trying to get off the ground basically have a hard time and are at a disadvantage when finding a distributor that's legally required to take it all the way to retail. And in recent years, there have been things like, you know, you can taste wine at a winery, or you can, you know, buy a bottle of liquor at a small distillery, or you can, I don't know, it just seems like with so many things, there's kind of a disintermediation, which is beneficial to customers and producers, and I just think we're kind of existing in this backwards ecosystem that's set up to kind of benefit, frankly, benefit a lot of lawyers, lobbyists, and that kind of thing, and is going away from kind of the disintermediated relationship with your producer that kind of a lot of Californians want. And so, just wanted to get your guys' perspective on if there's any hope of it moving away from a Jack Daniels model in the coming years, or whether we're just stuck with this because of who wrote the law.
So,
I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, before you go,
as I
understand
here.
Your question, what you really want to know in the heart of it is, are we going to be moving away from the large brewery conglomerates and down to the microbreweries when it comes to pot? Is that, in essence, what
yes,
you're looking at?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Now you can take your answer. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm just kind of worried that by the time we get there, all of the small producers will have been driven out of business already. And yeah, that's just kind of what I've seen happening, and it's really dismaying because a lot of people with passion and with a long history in the industry just kind of can't make it in the new paradigm. Okay, I'll take the rest off air. Sorry, it's easier to listen to on the radio than the phone. I can't hear you guys talk.
Alrighty, well, thank you for joining us. And you know, that begs the question of the paradigm itself and the law that's set up for it. Are we in a world where big business is going to be really controlling pot ad infinitum, or is it somewhat foreseeable that at some time you're going to have neighborhood producers?
So I'll take a crack at that one. It's really a fascinating question, to be honest. And I thank the caller. I didn't catch your name for raising it. I think we start from the opposite direction in cannabis, actually. We are starting with craft cannabis brands and producers. And the concern that many in the industry have, of course, not the ones who are looking to sell their craft businesses to larger businesses for, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in an M&A transaction. But the concern in the cannabis industry is that big alcohol actually is coming for the cannabis industry. And we have seen massive investments from big alcohol companies in the cannabis industry. Obviously, there's a substitution effect going on. We were talking about that earlier, or at least alluding to it earlier, with the effects of the pandemic. And alcohol is down as cannabis is up. I'm not suggesting or saying there's a direct correlation there. I think we start from more of a craft brewery model in cannabis, and there's a concern about the big boys coming in. And there are some regulatory regimes around the country that are set up to prevent that. For example, Massachusetts is very focused on not having, you know, too many large entities controlling too many of the licensees in Massachusetts. They want a diversity of licensees in that state. Oregon has something straight out of old alcohol regulatory world called tie house rules, where you don't want to have too close of a connection between people at different levels of the distribution chain. They are really using old alcohol regulations trying to enforce, I think, the craft cannabis type industry that our caller was asking about. It's a fascinating question, and the book is not written yet on whether we're going to see, you know, I think what the caller referred to as the Jack Daniels model of cannabis. We don't know yet.
You know, it took a long time for that change to come, even in something as simple as beer making, where after Prohibition, when one of the two or three largest brewers survived, we had two or three varieties of beer in the entire country, and they all tasted pretty much the same. And come the 90s, with the explosion of all the microbreweries, we now have a few thousand varieties of beer, and they can be very different. Do you think that it might take some time for all this to sort out in a similar fashion?
Well, Habib here. One thing that I'll say on the subject is that unlike in the brewery model or the winery model for the small brewer or small winery, where you can go to the actual brewery and have a beer or have a glass of wine, in the cannabis space, there doesn't exist that type of direct to consumer sale for the farmer, for the cultivator, unless they themselves have a dispensary license, right, or a retail license. So you can't go to the farm and purchase, you know, some product right there after touring it. So and that's been a big lobbying effort that's taking place to give the cultivator, the farmer, that opportunity. But as of right now, under the state regs, that's just not an available opportunity.
You know, before we took the call, we were talking about various types of contracts and what was enforceable. And we left off when we started talking about equity and that in some forms they're reluctant, to say the least, to enforce contracts that perhaps were designed to share a certain interest and make sure that income was flowing in from this to somebody. Would the same be true if the contract was a financing agreement where it was a fixed amount because based on a loan and not necessarily based on the on an ownership agreement?
Jeff, I think the answer to that question is most likely not, and I can't think of a case off the top of my head for that. But those cases have come up and in the federal courts as well, and the federal courts say that type of an agreement is enforceable even in federal court.
What about insurance? Businesses, oftentimes they can't exist without insurance. Right now we're seeing that with COVID-19, and people are making business interruption claims nonstop. Certain insurance companies, my understanding, the large ones, Farmers and so forth, will not insure cannabis. Smaller ones that are in-state will. Are these contracts or claims being enforced?
Well, Josh, this is Richard. From the employment side, I've seen that workers' compensation insurance policies have been responding to claims, that employers that buy those policies can use them. And also, a lot of employers in California, especially, or states like California with high litigation loads, have purchased an insurance product called employment liability insurance, or employment practices liability insurance, EPLI. And the clients that I know that have had that policy and been sued have been able to use those policies. I don't know whether those were local carriers or larger national ones, but I do know they've had some success.
And so one insurance companies claiming illegality as a defense is not working.
Well, I can only say that the clients that I worked with that had these insurances, the insurance was responding to the claims. They weren't taking a position that these claims couldn't be covered. So I don't know if in the larger, big national policies, maybe one of the other speakers might know that.
The other thing I wanted to know is when we were talking a little bit before the break and before the call about some of the things in the contract, such as whether you would want a forum selection clause to limit it to certain states or maybe rule out federal courts or the like. Has there been much in the way of arbitration when we started talking about pot-related contracts?
Yes, Jeff, and that's an excellent question. This is Brett from Goodwin. That's another option, but again, that's another whole program, if people find that interesting, on the differences between arbitration and in-court litigation. So there's trade-offs, like with anything. But of course, if you agree to arbitration of your disputes in your contract, your arbitrator is not going to refuse to enforce the contract for illegality. It's a private arbitrator who has no interest, he or she, in doing that. But of course, then you're in arbitration land, not in litigation land, and there are trade-offs that some clients and some lawyers don't like in arbitration. But that is another avenue to avoid being in federal court.
Jeff, if you were talking about employment disputes, then arbitration is an option that's not affected, in my estimation, by the subject matter that the employer happens to be a cannabis business versus any other kind of business. I will caution for those that are listening that are on the business owner side of this that arbitration is one of those things that is often advertised as it's a great solution to avoid court because it's faster and cheaper and it's easier. And I've often told clients that those are three reasons why you may not want arbitration in the end. Plus, under California law, if you require your employees, and you can require your employees, to sign an arbitration clause committing disputes to arbitration in lieu of going to court, then the California Supreme Court has said that the employer has to pay for any cost over and above what it would cost to file a lawsuit, which means that the arbitrator's daily fee for everything that the arbitrator does will be paid for by the employer. So it turns out to be way more expensive typically.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
I'm JL Richardson, in for Tom Power. Yola's music is often described as country soul. She calls it genre fluid. Whatever you call it, it's blowing up in Nashville. The English singer-songwriter talks about making the move to Tennessee. That's coming up on Q from PRX.
Cue from the CBC just ahead for the 7 o'clock hour right here on 91.7 KALW in San Francisco and online at kalw.org. And support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. For the details, you can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org. And we're back. California has made major changes in who has to register as a sex offender and for how long. Join us again next week at our usual time. We're going to take a look at what these changes mean for both public safety and for the ability of some of these folks to resume a normal life after what were sometimes very minor offenses. Next week on Your Legal Rights.
Going into the employment realm, to what extent can employers screen for lawful drug use, such as marijuana or alcohol, during work hours or during outside activities?
So, Josh, that's a great question. Let me start with the basics. I think an employer has the right to insist that all of its employees come to work, and they come to work not being impaired by any substance, whether it's a lawful substance or an unlawful substance. So, for example, an employer can have a rule that says you can't come to work under the influence of alcohol, even though alcohol is a lawful substance. The same is true with cannabis or actually any other drug. So I think employers certainly have the right, if they want to screen for that. And most employers I know do. A different question is when they're screening for it in job applicants, can they reject an applicant who happens to either consume alcohol or consume cannabis? And that's a much dicier question because we have a law in California that says, as I mentioned earlier, that an employee cannot suffer any adverse consequence. And that includes job applicants for having engaged in what's called a lawful off-work activity. That statute was written, by the way, at the behest of the tobacco companies some years ago, when they were afraid that employers were starting to impose health restrictions and maybe choosing employees who didn't have what they thought were, what some would say were bad habits, like smoking that would cause illness and as a result, maybe be a heavier burden on the insurance. Different question, though, that I think you were asking also is, if an employee comes to work and either uses cannabis before work or during their lunch hour or maybe on the way to work, you know, and such, can the employer take action for that? And I think absolutely yes, the employer can.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Jeff Hayden. About a year ago, we took a look at the legal environment surrounding the newly legalized cannabis market. We did not finish. Tonight, we're happy to take a look back and hopefully complete, if not resume, that discussion. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic or any question relating to cannabis law, transactions, and litigation. You're not limited to the point we may be in our conversation. We did get a call, we did get a question from a listener. Barring federal decriminalization, can contiguous Western states ever plan on a commercial distribution or sales within a Western state's corridor? Like, can Colorado decide to sell and ship products to Oregon or Washington? And can they Nevada ship to California, et cetera?
Habib here, that approach has been ballyhooed by a lot of the Western states in hopes to do that, but the answer is no, not right now, not where we stand, not until the federal government intervenes.
So we talked a little bit about the whether to the extent the employers could screen for that use. Can an employer implement a zero-tolerance policy, a zero-tolerance drug policy that includes cannabis?
In my estimation, Jeff, they cannot. They cannot preclude an employee, if they want to, from using cannabis, so long as the employee is not coming to work under the influence. A different question maybe for other federally illegal drugs that are also illegal in state, maybe they could, but I think from a privacy perspective, I would not recommend an employer to do that.
What if an employee has a medical marijuana card? Does a California employer have to recognize it?
Great question, Josh. The short answer is, as we speak today, the answer is no. The California Supreme Court ruled on this issue several years ago involving a company in the Bay Area called Raging Wire, in which the employee at the time alleged that he had a medical marijuana card, and because he had a medical cannabis card, that he was protected in some way from the employer's screening requirements. And so the employee didn't hire the person, and he sued. And the California Supreme Court said there's no privilege to use cannabis in that sense as an excuse to use cannabis while coming to work. Now, there could be an argument, and the argument wasn't refined very well at the time the Supreme Court heard it the first time. This was now maybe 10 years ago or so, maybe a little bit longer. And that is whether the federal and state laws that protect employees from disability might require some kind of accommodation to a disability if they get a doctor's note, for example, saying that they have a medical need to consume marijuana. You know, one of the great questions that we employment lawyers are always asking is, you know, whereas we know that under federal law, there is an accepted standard for what is being under the influence, an alcohol content of 0.08. There's no acceptable standard that I'm aware of for being under the influence of cannabis. And so therefore, you get into this dicey question of whether the person was or wasn't under the influence. Usually we recommend, if an employer has a drug policy, and we do recommend a drug-free workplace policy, that the employer have good reasons for believing that a person is under the influence because, for example, they've seen something in their behavior, and that maybe they had an unsteady gait or glassy eyes or some other external behavior that might lead the person to believe that this person is under the influence, in which case they would then send them out for a drug test.
Suppose they fail that drug test. What discipline is available to the employer? Can they terminate or otherwise discipline an employee that maybe fails that drug test?
Jeff, the answer is generally yes. That the tougher question, though, is what does it mean to fail the drug test? So you need to work with your drug testing labs, if you're an employer, to make sure that there's a clear understanding between the employer and the lab as to what level of concentration in the blood is going to be deemed, or in the urine for that matter, is going to be deemed being under the influence. And again, that's a standard which hasn't really been developed to where there's any general scientific agreement on what that is.
I remember there was a Seinfeld episode where Elaine Benes failed a drug test and she claimed she had too many poppy seed muffins. Have we gotten to the bottom of that? Any truth to that? Could you actually have the defense of the poppy seed muffin?
There are several substances that a person can consume which would result or could result in a false positive. The poppy seed was actually one of them. And so you need to talk to your drug testing lab again and coordinate on whether they are looking for certain other things that might be a cause for that false positive.
Just as a quick follow-up, does anyone know how many poppy seed muffins you'd have to take to blow high?
It sounds like Richard may have been a consultant to Larry David for that episode.
Yes.
Okay.
Maybe but not. Poppy seeds make you test for something far more insidious, which is opiates, and I don't recommend that to hide your pot use. It probably leads you down the wrong road. So suppose you are terminated for testing positive on a drug test for being under the influence of cannabis. Can you still receive unemployment benefits?
My understanding is the California Employment Development Department, which is the state agency that oversees who gets and who doesn't get unemployment insurance, takes the position that if you're fired for drug use or failing a drug test or anything like that, that you will be disqualified from benefits.
Let's shift gears for a little bit and talk about the running of a cannabis business. You have a thriving business. You're making lots of profits. Is commercial cannabis currently taxed under federal law?
Jeff, Brett from Goodwin, I'll take that one. I'm not a tax lawyer. At a high level, the answer to that question, and by the way, at a high level, we love puns in this industry, of course. At a high level, the answer to that question is no. It's criminalized. It's not taxed. There is no direct federal tax. There is a heavy tax burden on state legal cannabis businesses, though, because of operation of a provision of the IRS code called 280E, which disallows ordinary business expense deductions for cannabis industry companies. That's punishing because if you think about it, you know, most businesses are able to deduct substantial business expenses, and a cannabis business which does file a federal tax return cannot do that. They are only allowed to deduct what's called costs of goods sold. There's an interesting history, though. Prior to 1937, cannabis was legal at the federal level. And in 1937, a Treasury Department official named Harry Anslinger, he's pretty notorious in the cannabis industry, sponsored and got through Congress something called the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937. So from 1937 to 1969, cannabis remained legal at the federal level, but was taxed. There was a schedule, it's old history, so not worth going into, but it was essentially a dollar an ounce, which comes out to about $18 an ounce today. The Marijuana Tax Act was thrown out by the United States Supreme Court in 1969 in a case called Leary versus United States. Yes, Timothy Leary, Dr. Timothy Leary, versus the United States, he challenged the Marijuana Tax Act on the ground that the reporting requirements associated with paying those taxes violated your Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. So what happened next? The Nixon administration passed the Controlled Substances Act and just outright criminalized cannabis as well as all the other drugs covered under the Controlled Substances Act. So short answer is no, it's not taxed at the federal level now. It used to be. Now we just have the criminal prohibition with cannabis as a Schedule I drug.
Let me follow up with some switching over to the intellectual property realm. Can you get a trademark in the cannabis industry?
That one, unfortunately, Josh, this is Brett again from Goodwin, really does not admit of such a simple answer like the tax question. Basically, no. You cannot. The trademark office will not issue a registration for use of a brand, even a well-known brand. Think of your favorite well-known cannabis brand, you know, the MedMen dispensaries, some of our great cannabis brands here in California. They are disqualified from getting federal trademark protection. So all that money you pour into brand building, you really can't stop someone right now from setting up shop in a neighboring state or another state using the same brand. It's a real problem. There are strategies that trademark lawyers use to get some modicum of federal trademark protection. Just one example, you could probably get trademark protection or registration for merchandise bearing the brand's name. And this has sort of revitalized the state trademark registration practice, where what you do see are state trademark registrations in California and the other states because you can't get nationwide federal registration. Slightly different story on the hemp side. Hemp is no longer criminal since 2018. The trademark office will issue a certain registrations for hemp-related marks, but not if you violate FDA's rules, and that opens up a whole other can of worms because currently FDA prohibits the inclusion of hemp-derived things like CBD in food or beverages or dietary supplements. So it's pretty complicated landscape out there right now for federal trademark registration in the cannabis industry. There are some strategies, but it's a lot easier at the state level. You just have to do it across a large number of states if you want to get something close to federal trademark protection.
Well, let me follow up with that. We've had shows on what we call unfair competition, and there are state unfair competition laws. It would take too long to explain right now in this show what it means to be fair versus unfair competition. But there is such a thing as you competed and it wasn't fair. There's also a standard, and Brett knows this, on federal law for unfair competition. In fact, it falls under the same act that deals with trademarks, where if you don't have a trademark, you can also sue for unfair competition, even if you don't have that. Can you sue for unfair competition under federal law in the cannabis industry, even if you don't have a trademark?
That's a good one, Josh. And I haven't seen it. So I'm not willing to opine on whether you can or you can't, because maybe I'll find one of those cases one day. I don't know that there's a case that says you can't. The paradigm we're seeing a little bit more is the non-cannabis brand suing a cannabis industry brand for infringement of their registered trademark rights and unfair competition, right? So those cases do include federal unfair competition, but that's not the cannabis brand suing. It's almost always the non-cannabis brand. A very recent example involved the conglomerate that owns the Kool cigarettes brand. I think it's called ITG, and they have registration on the interlocking O's in the middle of the Kool name, and they sued a California brand called Bloom Farms, who had used the interlocking O's in the word Bloom, and I believe that was for trademark infringement as well as unfair competition. And that case ended with an injunction against Bloom Farms.
So your cannabis business is doing well, and you decide you want to expand. So some real basic questions. One is it legal to do so to where you could actually get venture capital to help back you up? And is it legal to do so under the law of the streets? How do you merge into other areas without getting your knees broken?
Habib here from Raghiani Freitas. So you are seeing more VC firms getting involved in investing in the cannabis space. It's becoming a little more frequent, especially with operators that are trading on the exchange in Canada. That's for sure. In my area of practice, I've seen some of the smaller private family investments getting involved in the cannabis space. They're a little more willing to take on that risk, right? You're definitely seeing investment in what we would call in the business ancillary service providers, right? The picks and the shovels, the tech platforms and whatnot. Those companies are having a much easier time of raising capital out there.
And Jeff, I'll take the second part of that. I agree with what Habib said. We are doing and seeing a large amount of venture capital and private equity money and family office money, to Habib's point, flowing into the expanding cannabis industry. In terms of how you expand, I think the second part of your question was about expanding into different geographies. And that really does get to the inability to ship cannabis across state lines, given federal prohibition. So there's probably a number of ways to do this, but a fairly common way is through an IP license agreement where you find somebody in that other state who has a license to manufacture cannabis products. You license to them your recipe. If it's a manufactured product, you license to them your brand. You can ship labels. So you can ship your labels from California, whatever your brand is, to your partner in that other state. But it's a lot more complicated in cannabis than it is in other consumer product industries because of federal prohibition. It can be done.
So we're getting near the end of the hour, and I wanted to give each of you a few minutes, no more than maybe 2 to 3 minutes, for any closing remarks you might have. Richard, you want to go first?
Sure, be glad to. thing I'd like to emphasize to the listeners, especially those that are running cannabis businesses, is that the employment relationship is very complex and very heavily regulated. There's over 20 government agencies I can think of just off the top of my head from the federal and state side alone, plus local agencies that govern one aspect of the employment relationship or another, whether it's equal employment, whether it's wage and hour, it's workplace safety, union management relations, pensions and profit sharing plans, insurance. There's just a whole array of things that employers have to know. And my experience working with particularly the smaller and medium-sized companies in cannabis is that they don't have good resources to give them the right start. And so they make mistakes. A lot of labor law is counterintuitive. I usually tell clients if it's logical, reasonable, and sensible, there's a very good chance it's probably wrong. And that most of the employers, they suffer from a disadvantage because they're looking at the law and surmising it ought to be this way because that's what I think. But on the other hand, if you understand that the laws are written to protect employees from employers, and you start looking at it through that lens, you might get closer to the right answer. So my closing remark is that I would think that it would be well in everyone's interest in the cannabis business to get themselves connected to someone who can provide them with advice and counsel about what the rules are so they get set up right and they do things correctly, because the opportunity for making mistakes that could be bet the business kind of mistakes are out there.
Habib here. I'll go second after Richard here. One of the things that I'm interested to see, that I'm sure all the practitioners are in California anyway, is the consolidation of all of the regulatory agencies at the state level. Up until just this past July, we had three separate state agencies that regulated and licensed the cultivators, the manufacturers, the distributors, the laboratories, and the dispensaries, and a couple of other different types of licenses. And they've now merged under the Department of Cannabis Control, who will issue a new set of regulations that will take care of any of the conflicts that existed between three separate agencies. So how are they going to process applications? How are they going to approve of mergers and acquisitions, which we really didn't get to touch on today. So hopefully we'll bring that back, because that's a whole other topic, because, you know, getting regulatory approval at the local and state level requires jumping through a number of hoops. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops over the next couple of months and years.
Brett, do you have a couple, if you want to take a couple minutes for our last comments?
Yeah, and I'll be brief. I guess what I'd like to leave our listeners with is we're talking about an expanding, very lucrative industry. I think I mentioned the current estimate of the size of the legal industry is around $20 billion in the U.S. alone, projected to be $90 billion by 2030. That's larger than alcohol. And there are people sitting in prison today for conduct that was illegal when they did it, that is legal now. And I've been working very hard when I'm not working with our, our private paying cannabis clients to try to get some of those folks out of jail, out of prison. There are people serving life sentences right now, today in 2021 in federal prison, exposed to COVID, exposed to all the horrible things that happen in prison for nonviolent cannabis offenses under federal law, under three strikes, things like that. I mentioned the social equity proposals at the state level. The current proposals at the federal level are also motivated by social equity. That includes not just throwing money at people who are adversely affected by the war on drugs, but actually letting some nonviolent offenders out of jail. I'm only talking about nonviolent offenders, not people who've killed anybody or gangs. There are a lot of people sitting in federal prison and state jail, state prisons right now for doing some of the exact same kinds of things that our clients do, only they do it legally with a license and make a lot of money doing it. So I would encourage people who are so inclined, who are interested in this industry, to get involved. There are lots of great organizations out there. I work with the Last Prisoner Project. There are many others working to try to rectify some of these injustices. And I think it goes sort of hand in hand or hand in glove with servicing and, you know, profiting off of the state legal cannabis industry.
You know, lawyers aren't known for talking short, but we do have a little bit of time left. So I'm going to go back to one of the questions that I passed over and didn't get a chance to ask you, because we do have a little bit of time left. Your point, Brett, is exceptionally well taken. And I would encourage anybody, lawyer, non-lawyer, there's always a place for anyone to help. One of the questions I didn't get to ask you, and we only have time for a short answer, is that a lot of leases, whether they're commercial or otherwise, have provisions in them that ban violations of law and ban nuisances. Where do we stand now in terms of somebody selling marijuana from a location? Perhaps it's lawful, perhaps it's licensed. Are those provisions nevertheless enforceable under nuisance? Can you evict somebody for selling pot out of a place you've leased them?
So, Habib here. So a couple things to quickly unpack there. Much like any other industry, you know, people always try to use standard forms, and this is not a non-standard industry. So you'll see the standard car forms that say that you can't have an unlawful purpose, you know, as part of the lease. So I always have those removed, right? And specifically state that the permitted use is, then go ahead and list whatever cannabis activity, whether it's, you know, retail, manufacturing, and whatnot. And make sure that that's specifically in there. You don't want to have that discrepancy, even though it'll be pretty clear to everybody looking at the lease that the landlord knows what's going on. The days of keeping it secret if you're a licensed operator are long gone. You want to be specific about it in your lease. And you also want to give yourself early termination rights if you can, if you have that leverage, because there's never a guarantee that you're going to get your license. You've got to or that you might lose it, and you don't want to be stuck into a lease if you lose your regulatory approval. So that's also something to keep in mind if you're reviewing a lease in the commercial cannabis space.
Thank you. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco, where tonight we resumed our discussion of the law relating to the business of cannabis. Our guests tonight have been, courtesy of Goodwin LLP in San Francisco, Brett Schumann, Richard S. Rosenberg from the Encino office of Ballard Rosenberg Gulper and Savitt LLP, and Habib Bentaleb of Rigatti Freitas LLP in San Rafael. And I thanks to each of our wonderful guests tonight for joining us. You know, California has made some major changes in who has to register as a sex offender and for just how long. Join us again next week at our usual time at 6 p.m. where we'll talk about what these changes mean for both public safety and for the ability of some of these folks to resume a normal life, sometimes years after very minor offenses. Our show tonight has been produced by Josh Borger and yours truly. Again, a big thanks to tonight's guests, Brett Schumann, Richard Rosenberg, and Habib Bentaleb. And especially our thanks to all of you for joining us. For Josh Borger, and at the controls, Damian D. Minor, I'm Jeff Hayden. Thank you to all of you for listening. Good night, and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.